In the summer of 2017, Studio MDHR, an indie video game developer out of Canada, released a one-of-a-kind title that merged the brutal difficulty of 1980s side-scrolling shooters like Contra and the early Disney rubber hose-style animation of the 1930s. The game was Cuphead, one of the most difficult side-scrolling shooters I've ever played, and I've played the old Mega Man games, and those games are pretty damn hard. I actually own two copies of Cuphead. One of them is on my wife's PC, and the other is on my Nintendo Switch. I love the animation so much that I wanted the ability to take it with me on the plane or while I'm on my lunch break. Cuphead is a masterpiece of a game that required over 60,000 hand-drawn frames. The other day, I was drawing for 2 hours on 3 pieces of paper, and I was exhausted. Can you imagine drawing for 60,000? Whew. Animation might look gorgeous and stunning, but it requires the highest level of artistry and technical skill to pull off. The amount of talent and work it takes just to make a 30-minute kids show is staggering, and the brilliant artists who work in the animation industry always have an interesting story to share. Speaking of things to share, if wisdom and insight into the animation industry crosses your path of interest, then you'll want to hear from today's guest, Deborah A. Anderson. Deborah is a professional 3D artist who teaches 3D animation to kids and adults through workshops and classes and on her YouTube channel, Black Woman Animator. She currently works as an animation specialist for the Louisiana Economic Development, where she translates illustrations and photographs into 3D stills. Our conversation today will cover everything from POC representation in the animation industry, Deborah's thoughts on big animation studios like Pixar and Disney, and we'll also dive into the everyday struggle of being a professional animator. We have a lot to talk about, so kick back, grab a drink, and tune in to another installment of Lag Radio. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm sorry about the chaos of everything. The whole change on Facebook sort of threw me for a limb. Okay. I'm super stoked that you're here. Could you tell me your name and tell me what you do?
So my name is Deborah Anderson, and I'm currently full-time. I'm an animation specialist with Louisiana Economic Development. So I do 3D modeling and animation for companies across the state with training materials. So I'll create like a pump or valve for a PowerPoint, or I'll do a video, animated video of their processes or some machinery on their facility. And that will go into a training video. So we work with like companies in the community college system. And then on the side, I go by Black Woman Animator, and I do a YouTube channel, and then I teach classes and workshops and try to get as many minorities and girls into animation as possible.
Oh my gosh, you have like the fullest plate ever.
Like 66% of my plate. I also am like of the Urban League Young Professionals, but that term is almost over, so.
Well, it seems that you're up to a lot of really cool projects, but I'm curious to know sort of how you got to this place. I think as a writer, I feel like my style has been cultivated, and it's only taken my late 20s to really realize that the way that I go about my creativity is so heavily influenced by like how I was raised and my own culture. And sometimes you don't even realize that, like, oh my gosh, like that's me, or that's why I'm into this stuff. How did you get into animation? Like, what was your relationship with art growing up? Was this something that you took on later on in life, or was this something that you've always been into?
Yeah, art has been there since I was like 5, or maybe even before. And so I always drew growing up, and I was always good at art and math. So I went through a lot of jobs. So to be like an architect. I want to be an industrial engineer. And I didn't want to be an architect anymore because I found out they didn't actually draw. And then before I found animation, I was actually going to become an electrical engineer because I'm also good at math.
Wow.
And then luckily I was smart and my dad found out about dual enrollment. And so I took seven classes, mostly art classes like Adobe Illustrator, Adobe Photoshop, and Flash, and all that type of stuff. And then the seventh class I took was a 3D animation class. So that's when I was surrounded by Disney. Like I had my Disney books, I was drawing from the books, from the VHS tapes, and all that type of stuff. But it just never clicked that animation could be a job. It was just. So when I took that class, my like senior year of high school, then I was like, oh, okay, I could do this. And it could kind of be a mesh of my analytical and my creative side too. Because it was pure animation, so
And so it took that one class for you to be able to sort of click that, like, was it a matter of the class teaching you that there was a path forward to carving out a career, or was it more of a like, oh shit, I'm like really good at this thing?
it was like, I was always good at drawing, so theoretically I should have known I could have gone into animation, but it was, I don't think I knew about 3D animation that much and how to click where I was like, okay, I can do this. It's fun. I like making things, so I'm like a 3D mo I go by Black Woman Animator, but I'm actually a modeler by trade, but the layman doesn't know what a modeler is, so I go by Black. And so I thought it was cool to like make the objects, and then and it wasn't even my parents, because my dad was always supportive, so it was just like I was kind of dumb. I'm like really smart, but then I'm really dumb sometimes. So
Well, that actually segues perfectly into my next question, because I actually want to talk about like how your family reacted. Because I know that for me and for a lot of artists of color, telling your family that, oh, I'm gonna be into this art thing, and there's, I mean, especially like for me, like as second generation immigrant, there's this perception that you can only have a career that is practical. And I know that you've mentioned sort of the pressure that a lot of young artists face to get a real degree. For you, how did your family react? What were some of the things that were, were there any pressures, for you getting into this field? Was, there a foundation of support?
So like mostly for my dad, because I was living with my dad at the time. So when my mom, it was like, well, my dad's gonna pay for college, so I don't really know what my mom thought. But with my dad, because they're not married, but with my dad, he's like, whatever you want to do. So he's like that with like jobs, with relationships, with everything. He's just like, whatever you want to do. He might not like it in behind the scenes, but sort of like in the forefront. So he was open to it, because he's kind of an artist too. He didn't pursue it or anything. He was like, he worked for the state of Michigan as a vocational rehabilitation counselor and stuff like that. He has like a PhD and a college professor, but he actually learned how to use his left hand to teach me how to draw. So he's like that intensive a parent.
Wow.
So yeah, like if I could just be half the parent he is. So it was a lot of support coming from him, and that's the all the support I really needed.
That's really cool. I mean, I know that right now you're a professor of 3D animation, right?
Yeah, I taught a semester at Loyola University, New Orleans, but I'm not currently teaching.
So how would you contrast the way that you are as an artist versus the way that you are as a teacher of art? Do you think that like you're more patient as a teacher? Do you think that you're more hard on your students than you are? Like, how would you describe that your teaching style versus how you are as an artist?
Yeah, like as a person, I'm harder on myself than anybody else. And as like teaching, as long as you try, I'm good. Like if you don't have to be perfect, like I have to be perfect for myself, which I'm trying to be delivered from perfectionism, which I'm on that journey. I'm not as much of a perfectionist as I was maybe 3 years ago, but with teaching, I'm just like, if you try, yeah, I'm good. I can teach you anything. But if you're like sitting there complaining, I don't have a lot of patience for complaining because it just is annoying. Something I'm also growing as a teacher, and something that I learned when I was teaching at Loyola was that I need, because me as a person, I don't need that much like feedback, like, oh, you're doing great. I kind of get it for myself, but for my students, I realized they needed that mostly because you're learning something that you don't have any idea if you're good at. And some of them were like doing really good, but I wasn't telling them that they were doing good. So they kind of were doing them themselves. And I'm like, well, my vantage point, I'm like, for a beginner, you're doing awesome, but I have to tell them.
Just
So
like getting into the habit of like actually verbalizing your thoughts
yeah,
and
just like treating people as they need to be treated, because I don't need that. So it's really hard for me to do that for other people. So learning to do.
so for you, for your own personal background, did you get into art school or are you self-taught?
So I did, well, also when I was in high school, my dad had me and I asked him if I could do art instruction school. So if anybody who is old enough to remember the like commercials where they were like draw the turtle or the pirate.
I remember that
Yeah. So I actually did that.
actually.
And so I did like 25 out of the 26 lessons. And so I still have my books in my on my bookshelf now, like where I did the lessons
Is
for
that one
that.
where you like draw st is it the one where you have to draw like these things that were on TV and then you had to like send it in?
Yeah, and then you could send in your own personal stuff, which if I knew they weren't going to give it back, I sent it. I drew a picture of Allen Iverson, and they didn't give it back. And I was like, oh, I should
I
have
should
took a copy of
copy.
that. I'm like, dang it, that was good. But yeah, so I did that, and so that actually gave me transfer credit when I actually went to college. So I
Wow.
did major in film, video, and animation at Rochester Institute of Technology, and so I do have a degree in film and animation.
Wow, awesome. I mean that also goes into my next discussion, which is art school. I know that you are aware of how a number of for-profit colleges have tried to scam a lot of students, and for a lot of artists who are looking to make a living off of their work, oftentimes the default is to go into some sort of art program. But there have been a lot of colleges that, they just load you up with massive debt for these art degrees. And so a lot of people are thinking, like, what is the viability of art school? How do you feel about the current state of art schools and art programs? How do you think artists should go about advancing their skills? Are there certain pathways that you would discourage and other ones that you would recommend?
Yeah, so I did have like, particularly in Louisiana, ITT Tech ended up, I mean, ITT Tech generally ended up closing, but I know a lot of old coworkers that kind of got taken advantage of by that program because they went to go get like a game design or animation degree, and their skills, they weren't taught as much as they should have been taught. And so at the very crux of art slash animation industry, as long as you can do the work and show that you can do the work, you're good. It doesn't matter how you learn it. So it's not if you go try to apply for a job and you don't have a degree, they don't really care, because the main thing that you're going to have to show is your portfolio or your demo reel. So the demo reel is if you take a video, like for me being a 3D modeler, I take a video of the 3D models that I make, kind of do a turntable of it, show my little wireframes of it, and then show like maybe two, three, four characters, and then put it on YouTube for people to see, and then I put that in with my application. And then maybe if you're a concept design, you're just like drawing your character concepts or whatever concepts that you're doing. And as long as you can prove, like as long as you have that proof that you can do it, your degree doesn't matter. But also for people like me, where self-learning is hard. So me, as if I can take a class to introduce me to it, I can then take it from there. But introducing it to myself by myself is very hard, because I think it's that analytical part of my brain that kind of puts my creative side in a prison, as I call it. And so I'm not as free and be able to play around and figure things out, which I'm also working on, because I'm trying to teach myself digital sculpting. And I like that's a lot of playing around, which is not my strong suit. So it's gonna have, in order to learn how to digital sculpt, like if, I'm gonna have to learn how to do it. But yeah, if you want to go get a degree, mostly it would probably be for the pipeline, like Ringling and some of those other colleges kind of go straight into Disney. So if you want to be strategic about it and you have the money, but you don't need to go to college to work in animation.
So is there like you're talking about sort of that pipeline of being able to get some of these connections.
Yeah.
If someone wanted to self-teach and they were trying to break into the industry, like is it as easy as like, hey, my work is phenomenal, I can go ahead and just apply? Like, what is the actual process like? I'm sure that you've gone through the actual interview process and being in depth within the animation industry. What is the reality like? Is it difficult to find work? Does the work pay, what it should? What is sort of the state of looking for work in this industry?
Yeah, for deciding to live in Louisiana, I've been like really lucky to find jobs. And in the current position I am in, I make a really decent salary. But I would encourage you to be in a place where you can get jobs, because also being in Louisiana, it's hard for me to kind of leave if I don't like something, because there's not that many, much opportunity. And it's not a matter of you have to go to California or New York. You can go to like a Chicago, you can go to Atlanta, there's Austin, there's these hubs. And even if it's in your own city, like where I'm from in Detroit, there's like an animation community where I could probably hop around and find different jobs. But just make sure that there is opportunities there, because I used to do more classes and workshops in New Orleans slash Louisiana, but then I stopped because I realized how much of an industry is not here. And also the culture of people from Louisiana is that when you're from Louisiana, you tend to stay here, or if you leave, you come back. So I didn't want to do a disservice to people to teach them all these skills and there weren't jobs, because they're probably not going to leave and go to California or go to Chicago. So
And are those the is California and Chicago sort of the Hollywood, the hotbeds for looking for jobs there? Like, is it, or are those the only real places that if you really want to get a good job in animation?
California is mostly going to be your like film and animation slash game studios. And then New York, there's also film and animation and game studios. Chicago is more your motion graphics hub, but they have more stuff there. Austin, I think they have like some game companies in Austin, Texas. And so there's just different pockets across the country that specialize into certain things.
Now, one of the ways that a lot of artists have been able to expand their reach and improve their prospects of finding work is through social media. And I know that you have an incredibly robust platform where you have a lot of educational material. You are bringing on people to have these conversations. And in a lot of ways, social media has democratized the art industry, and other times it also makes it more difficult because it's incredibly oversaturated. It's sort of like this double-edged sword of everyone can do this, but at the same time, everyone can do this. So, what advice would you give in particular artists of color who are looking to break through the noise And have themselves heard in an industry that does unfortunately prefer white stories and white artists.
Yeah, I think the indie industry is like the number one thing that's going to get people of color to tell our own stories. Because I feel like waiting for the big companies to do it is going to take forever. And while we should still be kind of calling them to the carpet and getting them to represent us, I think the indie industry and social media is like the pathway to us getting to it quicker. And so I would suggest create what you want to create, because the worst thing you can do, like if you like creating butterflies, create butterflies. Be the person that creates butterflies. Don't be the person like, oh, I'm going to create Pokemon characters, or I'm going to create this like other popular thing, and then you're going to hate what you create because that's what people are going to want to pay you for. So whatever your niche is, do that and be the person that does that. And then if you want to kind of grow and expand and learn different mediums or try different topics that you're interested in, then do that. But don't start doing what you think you should do. Do what you want to do, get really good at it, and then people will start following you for that. And then people will reach out to you like, oh, I'm working on a butterfly project. You like to do butterflies. So then you actually like what you do in your free time and what you do like for pay. So
And for animators that are, working on projects that they love, like what are the monetary opportunities there? Like I know that you can hire people off of different apps to, design my logo or design my YouTube intro. But other than getting hired at an actual I don't know what the actual animation organizations are called. But other than getting hired by those ones, like, is there a way to have a sustainable career, being a freelancer and just doing your own 3D work?
Yeah, like I have a video on my YouTube channel where I tell about how to properly use LinkedIn as a visual artist, because I've had people reach out to me for freelance stuff on LinkedIn, and I post a lot on LinkedIn. So if you're like posting your art on LinkedIn, and that could be a way that people find you. Instagram, and using your like some good hashtags, the proper hashtags, people can hit you up on Instagram. I've had people hit me up on Instagram, and I just don't have time to freelance because I actually have a full-time job. So I'm usually turning people down. And so I'm also sometimes trying to create a list of people that I can forward people to, because people will like the normal person will kind of see that I'm a 3D person, but not connect that to I don't do 2D. And so they'll like be asking me for stuff, and I'm like, I don't even do that, so I can't help you. So I try to like keep people in mind, like, oh, but I can pass you on to this person. So Instagram, like Facebook, maybe. There's ArtStation, Behance, Dribbble with 3 Bs. And so there's like a lot of sites. And also, if you kind of go to the forums and participate in the forums, help people out, have them assess your work, then you can kind of get your name out there.
Very cool. So you can sort of just like essentially do your own work on your different platforms and network that way by just reaching out to other artists.
Yeah.
As someone who has experience in the industry, what gripes would you have about actually working there? Because I know that like there's always when you're trying to land that job in the industry, you're like, oh my gosh, like I can't wait to be in this cool office and people are gonna be playing ping pong and it's just this creative atmosphere. But then there's always the reality of like, okay, but on the 9 to 5 aspect of it, like they're just you encounter the culture of the industry or you encounter the work-life balance of this type of work. What would you say are some of the aspects of working in this industry that people might not understand? What is it actually like? You said that you were a 3D modeler. What is it actually like in this space from a 9 to 5 perspective?
So something that's important is knowing like how long it's going to take you to do something. That's figuring out like my deadline for stuff has been a journey over since I've started my career. And so if you can like time yourself and know, okay, if somebody wants to you to create a house, oh, it's going to take me 2 days to create that, and then add on a day for good measure because you want to over deliver, under promise. And then also, and it depends on the industry, because now I'm working in government, so that's totally different from when I was working in South Korea at the animation studio. That was like 12-hour days, 6 days. So that was, but I was in my 20s, so it was cool. I could survive. But some of my gripes are being like, because I'm an old soul of sorts, and I've always kind of been more mature for my age. So when I was in my 20s and I was working some jobs, and they're like, oh, we got the Nerf guns, the cereal bar, and all this stuff, and I'm just like, okay, I'm not like this young person or this 20-year-old dude. Like, I don't care. I would rather you just pay me
Give me benefits.
like I'm getting paid peanuts, but yay, I have Nerf guns. So like, but some people are okay with that, but I'm just like, nah, just pay me what you owe. So, depending on the job you take, because people are always like, oh, I can be a game tester and get into the industry, but game tester is like the lowest paid job you've ever, you're not making money being a game tester. So just be aware that some jobs and some companies might pay low. And so that's why I would suggest to use Glassdoor, because I use that to research companies. And in particular in the animation industry, we all go to, if we go to school, we go to school to get a degree in animation. We don't get a degree in management or any type of leadership stuff. And so, the animation industry wants to be laissez-faire and be like, oh, we're just cool. And it's like, no, send your people to some leadership development. Because that's what I'll see on Glassdoor. Like, it's cool to work here, but the management don't know what they're doing. And it's like, that's like true for so many companies when I see it on, they're getting like 3 stars on Glassdoor because the CEO or the management suck. And it's like, stop thinking that getting leadership development will stifle your creativity. Like, the managers aren't the ones creating the art, so they can go to some classes, they can learn some stuff. But yeah, like, it's so laid back and people don't want it to be too stuffy, so they don't do that type of stuff. So that's another thing. Your management might be trash.
All right, so you said that you worked in a animation studio in South Korea. Can you tell me about like the work culture as an animator there versus animating over here in the States?
Totally different because I mean, there are companies that you work long hours in the States, but with Asian culture and Korean culture, it's just like staying the longest amount of time possible is what's impressive. And even if you're not doing anything, I was always doing something because I'm like the lowest rung, but sometimes the producers and the directors would just be taking naps and just be at the studio for like 12 hours. But it's like, go home, but that's the culture. Like, you just have to stay there. And so it was like, luckily, I'm not fluent in Korean. I know a little Korean and I always tried to learn, but Korean is like a level 4 language for English speaker, and the grammar always messed me up. And so I didn't get yelled at as much by my director because I was American. And so that was cool because they would warn me like, oh, Eddie, he's mean. But the background lady, she actually told me I made him nicer. And so I
Whoa.
think also my Americanness benefited my Korean coworkers because I felt like they pitied me. So they started like, there would be Saturdays where we just get off early. So we like on during the week it would be 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. But on the weekend we would get out at 6, but sometimes they would let us go at 3, like all of us. And so I think that was because of me. And then sometimes during the week they would let like one of us go, it would rotate, they would let one of us go at like 6 p.m. or something like that. And I think that was because of me too. They were like, ah, I don't think this American can take this, so let's do this. I'm like,
Hey, you're
it
right.
works for me.
I mean, to be honest,
Like,
I hate it when like companies, especially creative companies, like they want you to stick around as just sort of like the visual of, oh, you're around, you must be doing work. Like there comes a point where it's just like you're just doing it for appearances, whereas like your actual output of productivity, it's like you said, people are taking a nap. Now, as an animator, I'm sure that you have a list of companies that you respect and ones who you think, they're raising the bar for animation, and other ones that you think are probably a little bit more lackluster. How would you rate, and like, which companies and production companies would you say are doing it well? Which ones do you think are sort of dropping the ball? Where do companies like Disney and Pixar stand in your book?
So I like that Pixar is doing all the animated shorts and stuff like that. So, what they have with Float that just came out, and I had to buckle down and get like my Disney Plus trial so I could actually watch it, because it's only available on Disney Plus.
Oh
I'm
my
like,
gosh.
smart. And so they have all the animated shorts. They have another one that I did a review of called Pearl, and so that's on like sexism and like, I haven't like chosen companies, but I feel like there are particular movies that I feel are from my purview. Like Into the Spider-Verse was like the ultimate, okay, this is the direction that the animation industry needs to go. I feel like they just buckled in on all fronts, the writing, the animation, the innovation, all of that. And then the new Lion King is where we don't need to go. Like, why? I have a video on my YouTube about that too. Like, I'm just like, why did you have to do that? Like, So I just feel like the way that they keep, all the remakes that they're doing, they're not allowing people to come to respect 3D animation. And so with all the missteps that they're making, it's coming to a point where people hate 3D animation. And I'm like, no, but 3D animation is awesome. And then there's the thing of, oh, animation is for kids, so that's why some people didn't go to see Into the Spider-Verse, which is like one of the best Spider-Man movies, because it's animation. It's like, no, but it's a great movie and you can get something out of it even though you're an adult. And so it's like all these things where 3D animation is not being respected.
Yeah, I remember watching a couple YouTube videos where like people would call out all of sort of the animation faux pas and a bunch of these huge blockbuster movies, and I mean so many of them come out nowadays that I can only imagine like what the working conditions are like to have to produce these films over and over again. I mean, I don't know sort of the details of it, but I know that for example, like game designers who experience crunch and they have to, release this game in X amount of months, and so they're on these like ridiculous deadlines, ridiculous work schedules. I mean, I can't imagine what it must take to support sort of the animation of just Marvel.
Yeah, I feel like part of that is also what I spoke to earlier of like the leadership skill set, because I've heard about different people in gaming and in film where they were able to be good producers or leaders and were able to not have their team be in so much of a crunch. But I don't feel like that's prevalent in the animation industry, and they're not actively trying to teach people that. And so the people at the top are making these decisions, and you just have to do your job anyway. They don't really care if it takes you all this time and you have to crunch. And I just feel sorry for the people who had to redo the Sonic movie, because like, did you not do any focus group? Like, did you not understand that this was ugly?
I mean, I think they did a fantastic job on like the revamped version, but I mean, I can imagine like, yay, we worked on this project for like so long, and I know that like I heard that apparently a lot of the animators who worked on it had issues with that, and that was like.
But they not listen to. Because some dude who went to freaking liberal arts school and got a degree in sociology or something is making the decisions and like, well, I like it, but you're still an artist and you don't have the aesthetic eye to know that the masses are not gonna like this.
Yeah, it was I mean, again, I commend them for being able to turn around so fast, but yeah, I can't imagine having to work under those
People sociology degrees.
Now, in terms of, really iconic animation, more at least on the 2D side, I think for me, I think the first time that I was really mesmerized by the actual animation of something, not just like, oh, the actual film, but the actual animation of how things were sort of moving and how dynamic everything looked, was the anime Akira. And I remember looking at it and just seeing how everything looked incredibly fluid. And I know that it's such a iconic film that really pushed the boundaries of the capabilities of anime. In your opinion, what contemporary films or projects are changing the game and sort of elevating what you can do with animation or the types of animation that you'd like to see more of?
So a couple films like I liked Inside Out because it's kind of I actually have a necklace of sadness and that's weird to have that be your favorite character, but when you I mean for people who've seen the movie and really realizing the power of sadness to bring joy and stuff like that, but I like that movie for the topics that it covered, and then like a film like Zootopia, which was kind of tackling race relations.
Really? You know, that's weird. I remember hearing about that, about Zootopia being like a low-key, like huge social commentary, and I was like, what? Zootopia?
Like the bunny was, well, let's see, the like wolf, was it the wolf? He was like, I felt like he was like the black dude. And then like the bunny was like the liberal white person. I don't know. But yeah, and then like again Into the Spider-Verse, like that just clicked all cylinders of this is absolutely where we need to go. And then if you think about Peanuts, how they did that styling where they took the comic book style and transferred it into 3D. So those like Peanuts and Into the Spider-Verse of transferring that comic book style into 3D and making it palpable, I feel like is very huge. But yeah, I just feel like we need to, because they do all these remakes and then they some of the new storylines they have, it's just like the same old, same old. And I'm like, there's just so many cultures across the world that it might not be the a totally different story, but it's you can go to the continent of Africa, you go to Asia, not be stereotypical and have these like the stories you kind of grow up on, whether it's cultural stories or kids' stories, and like you could use that, but they keep like trying to just whitewash everything and just like tell the same stupid stories. It's just like, what? Can you expand?
Yeah,
And not
and
do it in like a Walt, like Walt Disney is like one of my idols, but not doing a Walt Disney way where you kind of bastardize it, but like do it authentically. So Coco, that's a big one.
yeah.
Moana, like do it like that.
So that, and that actually brings up a really good sort of debate that people have, especially when it comes to representation of people of color. How do you feel about the movies that do reboots and remakes, and then they shift the character to be more inclusive, and they go, "Oh, well, now Luke Skywalker is like Filipino Luke Skywalker or whatever," versus the people who say, well, no, I don't want that. I would rather have an original film with original story. Do you see merit in these remakes that are made to be, quote, more inclusive? How do you feel about that? And how do you feel about the direction of like where, like how we should be portraying people of color in animation?
I feel like it's I mean, I get it, but it's a cop out. I feel like it saves the money. Think about it. You do Little Mermaid. It's the script is already there. and you just put a black person, because they're not going to change it so that the black person, like the black person has an authentic story. It's just going to be Ariel with black skin.
Yeah.
And so it's saving them money, then they're going to get the merch deals and all this stuff, and then they're going to get the black dollar. So I feel like it's a cop out, and I think for the increase of diversity, and even there needs to be like the diversity in diversity, because sometimes I saw an article recently where they were saying how the minorities that get hired the most are pretty much the most centered to whiteness, and so it's like they're white with black skin or Asian features or Hispanic, and so I sometimes agree. So there needs to be more effort to all types of people in these demographics, not just the people that are love Star Wars, that love anime, that play video games when they're out. Like, it should be the people that like basketball, that buy Air Jordans and might stand in line. Like, just like the diversity of people. And that's kind of my mission. And what I do as Black woman animator is that I try to, because you don't have a neighbor that's an animator. So that's why I try to put myself out on YouTube and as many places as I can, so that you can know that I exist. I can also tell your parents that you're not going to be poor by going into art, especially the technology version of art. Like, if you set it up correctly, you can get a decent living. You're not going to be the pauper. You're not going to be like going down the street with your little bag of you're not going to have like your tin can. You can be prosperous and be in art. And then social media makes that easier. So I just want like so many people to be exposed. Like I have a diversity animation video on my YouTube channel, and I'm going full throttle. Like I want to be able to teach 5-year-olds animation.
Wow.
I want to be able to have, like, you know how the elderly have their little services, like create like a program where they can animate and be 70. I want to do it all. Like, I want it to be a hobby. I want people to respect it. I want it to be like just all over the country, the world, just everybody can do it.
Wow. I mean, I know that you also have experience. You're mentioning your Instagram experience with Cinema 4D, and that's, I mean, as a side note, like I've always wanted to get into it, but I sort of look at it and I see like the final pieces, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I can't imagine. I remember taking, I'm obviously not the same at all, but I remember in high school taking like an AutoCAD class, and I was terrible at
I
it, and
was
I was
important to
like,
lead
I was
the
like,
way.
I don't know how, like, given how much animation software has evolved and changed over the years, would you say that it's easier to get into? Would you say that it's more complex to do it nowadays, given how much is available? Because there's so many different programs, and a lot of them seem to work differently. Like, how would you say the difficulty is, and like the learning curve of something like Cinema 4D?
I advocate you getting into Cinema 4D, and if you need help, I will help you. Cinema 4D is like, from my personal experience, because Maya, Autodesk Maya was my first program, and then when I went to Korea, I learned Softimage XSI, which I had never heard of, but even before I went out there, and then I learned Cinema 4D for this current job. So Cinema 4D for me is like the easiest one,
Wow.
and the yeah. So also I have like two free courses. It's called Quick Start to Cinema 4D, and then 5 Simple Tools to Cinema 4D, and it's kind of targeted at like graphic designers, because I want to do a 3D for graphic designers course eventually. But I have those two on Gumroad, and so I feel like Cinema 4D, like, it depends on what your comfortability is. Something I teach students or people who want to get into 3D. It just matters no 3D.
Oh, sorry. I completely missed you for like a whole minute. Can you mention you? I think the last thing I caught from you was about your courses that you have.
Okay, so I have the a quick start to Cinema 4D course, and then I have a Five Simple Tools course that is targeted at graphic designers, because I want to do a 3D for graphic designers course at some point. And so those are co two courses I offer on Gumroad.com. But at the end of the day, I feel like whatever program you find and it's easy to you, use that program. And then something I teach my students and people who are interested in 3D, just go into the mentality that you'll always be able to learn another program. Because not only if you choose Cinema 4D, not only are you using learning Cinema 4D, you're learning 3D. And then if you go to Maya, you're just learning the tools. You're not learning 3D over again. So it's just like if you learn Microsoft Word, you don't have to learn how to type all over again if you use like
Google Docs or
it's
it
just you just gotta
transfers
learn,
over.
oh, I want to add a symbol. Which how do I add a symbol in this program? So it's the same thing you do for 3D. If you want to learn Blender, if you want to learn Cinema 4D, if you want to do the student version of Maya or 3ds Max, like just use those. And then know that if you get a job and you have to learn another program, because some of these companies have proprietary software, so you won't have access to that anyway. So you just have to have that mentality. I know when I worked at TurboSquid, they had a Checkmate advisory board, and a guy from Blizzard was saying that his gripe with new students is that they think, oh, I learned 3ds Max, so I just know 3ds Max. No, you know 3D. You know the tools in 3ds Max. You just have to learn the tools in Maya. You just have to learn the tools in Cinema 4D.
Yeah, so it's like the fundamentals just transfer over. It's just a matter of knowing that, tool A in this program is tool B in the other program. Now, going back in sort of the topic of representation, one thing that I've noticed that is so weird to observe is the changing of movies being more inclusive. And I know that several years ago, could have never imagined a movie like Crazy Rich Asians, or now that Henry Golding is in a Christmas romance movie. It's wild to see. Do you think that the industry is shifting in a trend where now they see the profitability of films that are more inclusive because of films like Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther, since they've done so well?
Yeah, I think capitalism is leading the way in this. So like after
Woo!
Black Panther and like Crazy Rich Asian, they're like, oh, we can make money off of these people. So it's not like tugging at their heartstrings to do this. But there are people like behind the scenes who are climbing the ladder that are making these changes and advocating for us. But for the majority that's still in power, it's also the aspect of the dollar, and the green is the most important color. And so I'm appreciative that that's, I mean, I guess that's in a capitalist society, that's a strategy. That you can make money and then they'll make more films for you. But as we continue to grow and expand, then push people up into those executive producer roles, showrunner roles, so that there could be that authentic voice, like the opportunity Issa Rae got and all this stuff. Like, because we know when it wasn't us that did it. We can tell. We're like, eh, that's just a main like a regular story with some skin, a different skin color, different eye. Like, we didn't do that.
Oh,
I
I
knew that.
remember I remember Dragon Ball Z. I don't want to go back there.
Yeah, I knew that black people had to do with Spider Into the Spider-Verse. I was like, though, just the opening scene, that just was like, it welcomed us in. The people who grew up in a like a New York City, or grew up black, or grew up just like in that, because the way he was singing to the music and didn't know all the words, like that's that authenticity of dun, 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 dun. Like, you knew that was us. And then when I just reviewed the short film by Jamal Bradley, Substance, like the way there was an opening scene where the guy is walking down the street, and just the way he walks like Obama. Like, so you know that, like, I guess maybe a white animator could have done that, but in America, a black animator did that.
And that really does speak to the sort of the need to have people who are in the culture working on the actual creative, because there's just so many subtleties, like even it, whether it's animation or whether you're talking about cinematography, like being able to have people who are of the culture who know specific things about like, hey, the set should look like this, or the character should walk or talk like that. Like it's so important that, and it's oftentimes overlooked, like you said. So often we just see these movies that are just you. It might as well be a white person, but it's just they're Asian or they're black.
And that cinema photography piece is huge. That's why people there has been articles about that with Insecure with Issa Rae, like the purples and the blues that they use on the dark skin stuff like that. And then also I recently watched Dolomite Is My Name on Netflix, and that was something that Derrell Martin, which was who played by Wesley Snipes when they were like shooting the movie, he was giving some education. He was like, is that the DP? And Eddie Murphy's character was like, what? The director of photography, like, does he know that black people skin absorb light and then white people reflect it, so you have to know that? I was like, yeah, they teaching people something a little if you were paying attention. So like, yeah, that is very important, and that's why I'm here too, because I also did like I responded to when they tried to change Princess Tiana's color in the Wreck-It Ralph film, because they like came out with her, she was dark skinned in like a July trailer, and then in the September trailer she was like light skinned and she looked mixed. And so Disney strategically never commented on that. But
Really? Uh-oh.
Anika Nani Rose, which was the character of Princess and the Frog, she commented on it, and she said they told her, oh, the lighting and all this stuff. And it's like, bold face lie. That's why we need black animators, because I'm calling BS. Because how it works in animation, if you can light a black suit, like from Hotel Transylvania, you can light a black person. And the thing you can do in 3D that you can't do in real life, you can call light linking. You can link a light to the person that doesn't affect anybody else. So if they're darker in the scene, you could just add a light for them and light link it, and then not make it affect any other character, and then you could see them. So no, that's why. Oh, the lighting. Yeah, that might be true in real life where it's hard to take a picture of a bunch of white people with a dark skinned person, but in 3D, no, you do not have that excuse.
Yeah, not at all. And that's an you bring up a good point, because at for me, I'm a photographer, and I always am, frustrated when photographers aren't aware of, whether they're doing video or whether they're doing photos, recognizing that you have to light people differently. Like a really pale white person is going to be lit very differently than someone who has more tan skin. And I, like you mentioned, Insecure, and I know that like Luke Cage and Moonlight, I think that the director of photography also was talking about that same thing, about understanding that you need to sort of approach the lighting differently. And I think it's kind of cool because it adds a different creative layer, like, oh wow, like you normally don't see it shot this way, and I think it's kind of cool to be able to see that played out.
Yeah.
Now, as someone who you work in the creative field, and a lot of the projects that you do, I'm sure, are things mainly, for specific clients. How do you reconcile the work that you have to do for the job versus the type of creative work that you want to do for yourself? Like, what types of work do you like to do? Like, not you with no intention of like, oh, I'm going to monetize this or whatever. Like, what type of artistic work gives you meaning that you actually just legitimately enjoy doing yourself?
Yeah, so like I was saying earlier, I'm also in my free time, I'm the president of the Urban League Young Professionals. So like my dad calls me Angela Davis, and like he raised us to be like black power. And so a lot of the projects that I'm interested in working on, because I don't have the time now, like in 2020 I will have time because I'll have much more free time, but it's mostly like historical and not just black. Like I have, because I have folders on my computer of projects that I want to work on, like Native American, like the Sikhs, or just the Black history of acknowledging that there were Black cowboys. From where I'm from, like all the people from Detroit, I have projects that I want to do. Even like I have like a stylish kids project. So it's like just representation and just like showing all these different types of people. And so that's like mostly what I want to do. And one project that I did in 2007, it was based out of a conversation that I had with some guys, and they were talking about avatars in video games. And they were like, for Black guys, you can have like maybe a fade, an afro, and some dreads. It's like that's it. And so I created a project called the Black Hair Alphabet. And so I did like a daily project, and that was particularly when I was teaching at Loyola. So I don't even know why I did that to myself. Like I was waking up at like 3 o'clock in the morning so I could work early, so I could leave work early, so I could go teach. And then at night I'm like, yeah, let me do a daily project to really make it fun. And so I did like A is for Afro, B is for Bantu knot, C is for conch, D is for dreads, E is for edge up, F is for finger waves. And so like I did like not every hairstyle is a Black hairstyle. But when you only have 26 letters, like you just got to do what you got to do. So V is for victory rolls, which is like the army rolls from back in the day, like the 20s or whatever. So, like I did that because I wanted to show in my current skill set that you don't have to just have three hairstyles for a Black person. And then another iteration of the project that I want to do is I want to learn how to do realistic hair in 3D. And so I'm going to revisit the project when I can do realistic hair. And so that even more to show them, to prove to them like it's possible. Like you can do a fade in 3D and it'd be accurate. It doesn't have to look like trash.
Yeah, I know that I've heard from a lot of people who are irritated with the, every games every RPGs create a character in like the two styles of it's like either the afro or bald or something, like it's just like so limited. Now for you, when it comes to developing your ideal environment to create, like I think every artist has sort of like, okay, I need this thing to be in order, I need to be in this particular outfit or in this particular place. For me, like I like to have things incredibly quiet. I like to have things incredibly dark and just sort of like in my own little corner. I prefer to write super late at night because I feel like it's, everyone's asleep. I have nothing to sort of bother me. For you, how would you describe your ideal creative environment?
Yes, I kindred spirits on being a night person. Shout out to Dre from Blue Sky because he's trying to get me to be a morning person, and I am. I believe that I could be as successful as I possibly can be and not turn into a morning person. Like I refuse. I feel like morning people just were created because of electricity. Like we have electricity now. I don't have to be a morning person. So night is my thing, which it kind of does myself a disservice because I have a real job and I have to leave my house at 6 a.m. so I can wake up at 5.
Oh,
And
yeah.
so sometimes I stay up till 12 and 1 and then I'm like tired the next day, but whatever. And then I like quiet. I hate noise. But I don't have like any particular outfits or anything. I might listen to music sometimes, but mostly I like quiet and just getting into the vibe of doing stuff. And that's something really I'm trying to get back into because over the past 7 years of like being in this social action organization, I've given away of myself a lot and not spent any time on me. So I'm not even connected to what my setup is because I feel like I haven't been an artist to the T to the extent that I want to. So I'm like kind of guessing at it. But in 2020 and on, I'll be honed in on what I need to be creative and kind of get back to how I was in college when I'll be in a computer lab and like get lost in it. And like 3 hours later, you're like, oh man, wow, 3 hours passed. Like I haven't felt that since college. Well, I might have felt it in Korea maybe, but like I'm so disconnected. Like I even took it as far as like not, I didn't feel like I could have could create call myself an artist because I wasn't creating art. So that's in the past 3 years how me trying to create more art so I can actually authentically call myself an artist.
Yeah, it's you touch on a really good point about how, when you do creative work for your job, like obviously you're going to pour yourself into it and do the best that you can. And I think sometimes it's hard to explain this to people who don't have creative jobs. Like, surprise, surprise, being on a computer, there is a type of exhaustion. It might not be the type of exhaustion that you get from walking around and doing something a little bit more physical, but like there is just a mental exhaustion. And some days like the creative spark just like isn't there and you just can't like activate it at work. And so it becomes even harder when you try to go back home after a long day at work and then you're like, okay, well now like I have no juice to be able to do my own creative work because like I'm just so exhausted. Yeah, I mean it's hard to be a working creative and then a creative who wants to do creative stuff for yourself.
And then, in addition, particularly being in the South, there's some aspects to whether it's through networking or at work, like the racism and sexism that I endure sometimes, and just not, I have to like get that fervor because sometimes you just don't want to go to work because of what you deal with because of the color of your skin or because of your gender, and it kind of affects your artistry. And so you might not want to come home and do that or something like that. So it's like all interconnected. And so I'm just trying to get back into having that fervor for like I have the fervor for animation and teaching people animation, but for my personal projects, I'm trying to get that motivation and that fervor. Like, yes, I want to create for me and get excited about it.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I'm still, sitting on so many drafts of projects that I've like barely started and I'm like, oh my gosh, like there's so much stuff that, like I want to finish, but it's just sort of like a oh gosh, like sitting in my inbox waiting to be complete. Speaking of projects that are currently on your plate, what are some of the bigger things that you're working on right now, and where can people find you?
So, something that I'm working off is like my 2020 demo reel because I plan on making some moves and trying to get a new job. So, something that I learned when I was in Korea. If anybody knows like the story about how I got my job in Korea, I did not get it on purpose. They asked me if I had a demo reel. I said I did not have a demo reel, but I could have one. So for the over the next 4 months, I spent time making a demo reel, and that kind of showed me that like when I was in the States and was trying to apply to stuff, I did not have a demo reel, and that's why I was not getting a job because I was not properly prepared. So I'm trying to properly prepare myself, have the correct stuff, my demo reel, so that I can get a new job in 2020. And so that's the main thing I'm working on, trying to do some environment modeling stuff. And then just continuing throughout the year of posting on my YouTube channel, because in January I made a goal that I'll post weekly. And so I feel like I was asking my dad, I'm like, is this the most consistent thing I've done in my adult life? Post weekly on a YouTube channel. But yeah, so trying to keep doing that and trying to keep bringing kids, girls, college students who need help in animation. I have a couple people that I'm mentoring through email and just trying to encourage everyone. Because in my industry, people aren't like me. They just want to create their video game, they want to create their film, but they're not in creating in, interested in creating more animation professionals. And that's like what I want to do. Like I need to be selfish in 2020 and create my own art, but I'm also trying to help you all, and I'm open to it because some people either give you like subpar responses or they just stop responding. So I'm always going to respond. I'm always going to like email you back and stuff like that. So that's another big thing that I'm trying to continue. And so to find me, you can find me at like Black Woman Animator on pretty much any platform. And so that's BLKWMN Animator, all one word. And so I'm on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, all the things.
Awesome, awesome. Before I let you go, Deborah, is there anything that you want to plug? Any Any particular message or thing that you want to advocate for before I, you know, send you off?
I want to quote something from my blast YouTube video for my professionals out there. Start now. You don't need to do more research. There's nothing else you need to do but start.
Oh,
And for
yeah.
my perfectionists and procrastinators, and for anyone else, just do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that is, I mean, especially for like working on creative projects, and like I have notebooks and notebooks where I'm like, okay, I'm gonna do this. This is my first step. And then you always are just revising your plan and your strategy to do the thing that you just need to do.
Yes, that's me. 2016, I created my own hashtag. It was called action and educate action and execution, because I'm the type where I would read 50 articles about something and still not doing it. So execute. And there's somebody who is not as talented as you that's more successful because they're just putting it out there.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's that is the sort of harsh and, you know, positive reality of it, which is like, as long as you put in the work and you just do something consistently, like even if it is so bare bones and shitty at the beginning, like it's so much better to have, you know, 50 projects in the bank that are kind of whatever, and then just improving over time, as opposed to hoping that your first, you know, breakout piece is like amazing.
Yes. That's the perfectionist.
Yeah.
Like, then you think it's crappy. Like, I did like a daily challenge, like Sculpt Timber or something, or maybe Sculpt January. And I would think it was crappy. And then I post it, and they're like, oh
Yeah.
my gosh, this is
And
awesome. I'm
you're just like, I got so stressed for nothing.
like, right.
Awesome. Well, Deborah, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I've been following you for a while. You're awesome.
Thank you so much. All right, I will hopefully we'll definitely have to invite you back again sometime.
Okay.
All right, take care, Deborah.
You too.
Thank you for listening to another installment of Lag Radio. Lag Radio is an independently produced podcast recorded and edited here in my home office, so I appreciate any and all support. Whether you share this podcast with your friends on social media or sign on to become a sponsor, there are plenty of ways that you can help out. Speaking of which, if you're a small business owner or a person of color who wants to promote your platform, business, or brand, contact me and you can become a sponsor of Lag Radio. We'll have you sponsor some of our episodes, and you can even join on to be a guest of the show. If you'd like to listen to previous episodes, you can find Lag Radio on anchor.fm/lagradio, or you can listen on any major podcasting app like Google, Spotify, or Apple.